From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with two writers who have chronicled their very different journeys. Eddie Harris is an African-American who was drawn to visit the continent of his ancestors. He'll tell us why his journey left him disillusioned with the continent and Afrocentrism. Writer Nick Cohn tells us what he found along his much shorter journey up one of the most celebrated streets of the world, Broadway. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of motets by German composer Heinrich Schütz, conducted by Craig Smith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush campaigned in New Hampshire today and will return to the state this weekend for a last-minute push before Tuesday's primary. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Although the Bush campaign has already raised millions of dollars and has been running ads in New Hampshire for weeks, the president formally announced his candidacy this morning in a room filled with loyal supporters. He then hit the campaign trail, spending an event-filled day in New Hampshire. While most of his appearances were carefully controlled, he ran into a sizable group of protesters at the state capitol who had come from Maine to demand that he pay taxes in the state where he keeps his summer home. The Bush campaign had originally planned to keep a low profile in New Hampshire, but is now accelerating its efforts before Tuesday's first-in-the-nation primary. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Manchester.
House Republicans reacted angrily today to a Democratic move to send President Bush's economic growth package to the floor. The strategy is aimed at embarrassing the president by showing that a majority of Democrats and even some Republicans will vote against it. The president wants his plan to be considered in two parts, with seven proposals to be considered now and the rest postponed until later in the year. The seven immediate proposals include Mr. Bush's plan for a generous cut in the capital gains tax, which Democrats claim will benefit the rich. House Speaker Tom Foley said that Democrats will present and pass their own substitute for the president's bill by his deadline of March 20th. Leading sports officials in Germany say they're increasingly convinced that three top German track and field runners manipulated tests used to detect steroid use. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
In Bonn, the Parliamentary Sports Commission today discussed the growing doping controversy over three East German athletes, including popular sprinter Katrin Kaba. Recent urine samples taken from the former East German athletic stars were unusually similar. One top investigator who tested the samples said they were definitely manipulated, a charge the athletes deny. Other experts claim three athletes eating the same diet could produce virtually identical urine samples. But after the closed parliamentary hearing, sports officials said they believe the athletes hid prepared urine samples in their bodies. The athletes face up to a four-year suspension from athletic competition if it is proven they tampered with urine tests to circumvent doping controls. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
Stock prices closed at a record high today. It was the 10th record closing on Wall Street so far this year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 25 points to close at 3,276.83. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 230 million shares. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. American Telephone and Telegraph Company said today that it's made a deal to sell telephone equipment in Russia. The company said that it formed a joint venture with Russia's only maker of phone equipment to be based in St. Petersburg. AT&T will own 68% of the new venture, which will sell digital phone transmission equipment that's made in the Netherlands to fit Russian standards. Researchers report a new treatment that artificially stimulates labor and cuts down on the number of cesarean births. Currently, one out of every four births is delivered by cesarean section, even though the operation is expensive and risky for the mother. NPR's Patricia Naimond reports.
The treatment is called active management of labor. Doctors closely watch the progress of labor, and at the first sign it's going too slow, patients are given high doses of the drug Pitocin, which is a synthetic hormone that stimulates contractions. In a study at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, women who received active management delivered babies, on average, 2 hours earlier than expected, and the rate of C-sections declined by 26%. In today's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers say active management proved safe for both mother and baby. They say if this treatment was routine across the country, far more women could have normal deliveries, and the healthcare system could save millions of dollars. In Washington, I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
The New York Attorney General said today that General Mills has agreed to drop a national advertisement claiming that its Total cereal is good for unborn babies. A spokesman for the Attorney General's office said the ad, aimed at pregnant women, is the first in the nation's history that makes claims about fetal nutrition. General Mills denied any wrongdoing in the ad, which contained claims such as Total is the one when you're eating for two. The whole wheat cereal is sprayed with extra vitamins and minerals. The agreement to withdraw the national ad was made in a joint settlement with New York and Texas. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many African Americans think of Africa as their homeland and hope someday to journey there to learn about Africa and to learn about themselves. My guest Eddie Harris traveled through the continent, but he did not feel at home there. He explains why in his new book, Native Stranger, A Black American's Journey into the Heart of Africa. This trip was in part to find out who he was. On a previous trip, he tested what he was made of. He traveled down the Mississippi River alone in a canoe. It was the subject of his first book, Mississippi Solo. Eddie Harris lives in St. Louis. Before we talk, he's going to read from the opening of his new book, Native Stranger.
Because my skin is black, you will say I traveled Africa to find the roots of my race. I did not, unless that race is the human race, for except in the color of my skin, I am not African. If I didn't know it then, I know it now. I am a product of the culture that raised me, and yet Africa was suddenly like a magnet drawing me close, important in ways that I cannot explain, rising in my subconscious and inviting me. It was time I went, and when an acquaintance asked what I planned to do next, where I planned to go, it was as if some invisible hand moved me to go there. I answered without missing a beat, Africa. In the mind and perhaps dreams of every person with black skin, the specter of Africa looms like the shadow of a genie, dormant but not altogether harmless, always there, heard about since childhood as some magnificent faraway world, a place of magic and wonder. Africa as motherland, Africa as a source of black pride, a place of black dignity. Africa as explanation for the ways of black men and women, their ways of walking and their passion, their joys and their sorrows. Africa as some germ in the genes that determines more than skin and hair. Although I am not African, there is a line that connects that place with this one, the place we come from and the place we find ourselves, those lives and our lives. And I longed to follow that line. But what if those old promises of Africa were only lies? What if I hated the place? Only in traveling there could I discover the truth.
Did you think of Africa as your homeland before you went?
I really don't think so. As a black person, you hear about it all the time. And yet, I didn't really feel that it was homeland. I don't know what I felt about the place, but I don't think I really saw it as my homeland, the homeland of my ancestors, certainly, but not specifically of me or my family.
Why did you want to go to Africa so much?
Well, I travel a lot, and I've traveled to all the places that white America goes to, Mexico, Canada, the U.S., Europe, and I just thought it was time to go to Africa, go someplace specifically black.
Did you find that a lot of Africans were confused by African-Americans who do consider Africa their homeland?
I don't think it's a thing that Africans think about.
Mm-hmm.
They were certainly welcoming, happy to see me because I was black. But a lot of Africans don't even know that blacks live in the United States. I mean, they know there are blacks in Jamaica and blacks in Brazil. But a lot of Africans don't realize that there are so many blacks in the U.S.
That seems surprising to me.
Well, it was surprising to me, too. And I can't explain it, but but that's the way it was.
You actually started your trip in Paris, which has a large African emigre population because France had colonized so much of Africa. So your first encounter with Africans on the trip were Africans who had left their country to live in a European country. It's kind of a paradoxical way to start, in a way.
Well, in a way it is, but I was looking for a bit of comfort before I hit the hard road. And also, Africans in Paris still have, unlike black Americans in this country, Africans in Paris still have that lifeline that connects them to Africa. And I knew that when I encountered them, I would be wading into Africa in shallow depths.
You said that when you got to Africa, your plan was to be as African as possible. What did that mean when you got there?
Primarily, it meant doing what the guy next to me was doing, just living life the way he does, and not as a tourist. I've talked to a lot of black Americans who've been to Africa, and they all come back with this completely different experience than the one I wanted when I went and the one that I've had now that I've been there. They all talk about the big cities. They all talk about being shown tribal ceremonies. They all talk about being treated like royalty. And I wanted to go just like a common person in Africa, not part of a tour group, not with some special agenda, just to go and see what was really going on in the cities, in the bush, every place.
So do you think that gave you a really different impression of Africa than your friends who went the more tourist route?
Well, certainly, because they come back still professing this great tie to Africa, this cultural heritage connection. And I came back with completely the opposite feeling. I mean, what's going on in Africa and what's going on in my life are not connected culturally at all. If there is a connection, the connection is on a human level, not on a black-to-black level.
Give me a sense of what kind of incidents led you to reach that conclusion.
Every time I ran into the police or the military and they wanted to shake me down, and every time they encountered the police, the military encountered other Africans and shook them down, the response was completely different from the one that I would have given or the one that I gave. I was in Togo, and a cop drove by on a motorcycle, on a little scooter, a moped, and the pedestrian stepped off the curb a little too close to this guy, and he reached his hand out and slapped the guy. If he had slapped me, my response would not have been the passive response of the typical African, which is to take whatever happens to you. My response would have been to clock that guy and knock him cold, in which case he would have pulled a pistol and shot me. But still, my response as a black American is not nearly as passive as the responses to situations that black Africans come up with.
Do you think that what you're interpreting as passivity is just what you have to do to get by without getting shot?
Well, yeah, it is. That is what you have to do to get by without getting shot. But I think at some point you have to stand up and make yourself be accountable for what's going on. And a lot of what's happened to black Americans is a result of doing what's necessary to get by. And I think we as a people would be a lot stronger, a lot farther along the road if we didn't just stand by and do what's necessary to get by, but said, this is the way things are, this is the way things ought to be, and I want the way things ought to be.
Did you feel that a lot of the political problems that you saw and a lot of the repression that you witnessed was the legacy of colonialism?
Yeah, I think a lot of the repression is the legacy of colonialism. But the colonialism continues not simply because of the Europeans, but it's also been continued and fostered by the blacks who are in power, by which I mean colonialism now has a black African face, and repression does not come from Europe alone. Repression comes from having too much power and the means to wield that power.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eddie Harris, and he's written a new book about his travels through Africa. It's called Native Stranger. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Eddie Harris is my guest, and we're talking about his trip through Africa. It's the subject of his memoir, Native Stranger. You were talking about how different your experiences in Africa were from friends of yours who went to Africa as tourists. I think a good example of how different your experience was is the time that you were arrested in Liberia. Would you tell the story of what happened to you?
Well, I was crossing the frontier from Ivory Coast into Liberia, and because of the way I was traveling, which was going where the guy next to me was going and taking the same buses, the same roads that he was taking, I was led to a border crossing that isn't for the typical tourist, but just for locals who happen to work on one side of the frontier or the other, but live in the other country. And so I went down this road, came to the frontier, crossed the frontier, and was searched by the Border Patrol, as everybody is. And in my possession, they found a camera, some film, a map, a pair of binoculars, and a small tape recorder, micro tape recorder. And so the guards assumed and were absolutely certain that I had to be a spy to carry this kind of paraphernalia with me. And so, not knowing what else to do with me, they threw me in the slammer for a week.
Describe what the prison was like.
Well, the first prison was just a big army barracks where they detained me because they didn't know what else to do with me. And they didn't have a phone, they didn't have a radio, and they didn't have the authority to shoot me, so they didn't know what to do, so they just held on to me for a few days and then finally decided it would be best if they just sent me to Monrovia, the capital. And they gave me an escort, an armed escort, and he took me down to the capital and turned me over to General Craig, I think, at the Barclay Training Center, who realized right away that it was a mistake. But in order to get completely free, I had to go through the Ministry of Immigration, and that guy decided to make a test case of me. He didn't like Americans. He didn't like black Americans. He didn't understand why black Americans didn't move back to Liberia, or moved to Liberia. And so he threw me in jail even longer. And the prison was an immigration prison. The people who were there were all illegal immigrants, I suppose. And the conditions were just despicable. There was no sanitation. There were no toilets in the cells. And you had to buy your own food. And these other guys, of course, didn't have any money. And so I being the only person who did have money, ends up buying food for everybody else in jail. It was just absolutely incredible.
Is this typical in some African countries that you have to buy your own food while you're in prison?
Well, from what I understand, it's the case in every prison. If your family doesn't bring you food and if you don't have enough money to buy your own food, you just don't eat.
Yeah, I think one of the great frustrations that you faced on your travels through Africa was incompetence and stupidity on the part of bureaucrats who had no idea how to handle a problem and would just pass you off from one person to another.
Well, that's exactly what happened in Liberia. The bureaucrats aren't trained. They happen to be of the same tribe that the ruling dictator of the week is, and so they get a job.
So I think we've covered some of the frustrations that you felt during the trip. What were some of the great pleasures, some of the great revelations?
The greatest revelation was, the two greatest revelations are the incredible generosity, I suppose, and just the amount of endurance that black Africa has, or Africa in general, even Arab Africa. Just the fact that humanity can face this kind of suffering and deprivation and still smile and still share with you and still continue hoping for and expecting tomorrow. Whether tomorrow is going to be better or not isn't really the issue there. It's just that tomorrow will come, and when it comes, we or they will be there waiting for it.
Did you have any great revelations in terms of your own identity as an African American during the trip?
Well, the great revelation, I suppose, is that I'm not African. And my roots, if I'm looking for my roots, are going to be in Mississippi or in Georgia or Alabama or someplace in the American South. And I, as a people, began, I suppose, in 1658 or whenever the first European ships bringing African slaves to the New World came.
Is this an unpopular view to have among your friends?
Not among my friends, but certainly among the monolithic black American hierarchy, I think. I think there must be some sort of payback in this Afrocentric movement that's occurring now. I don't know what the payback is. But in my view, it's limiting, and it's always negative, and it's always seeing Black America or Black Americans as victims. And it seems to be comfortable to wallow in that victimization. And I don't want to be there. And I think that for Black America to make strides toward the future, we need to make some really hard choices. And one of the hard choices is to realize that this is where we are. We are here, we are now. It doesn't matter how we got here. The important question is, how do we get from here to a better place?
How do you see Afrocentrism as tied to victimization? Because a lot of Afrocentrism isn't, it's not just like the Middle Passage, it's about life in Africa.
Yeah, it is about life in Africa, but it always seems to revolve around how we were stolen from Africa and enslaved, and I don't know what else. But but it seems to be about how we were stolen from Africa and enslaved, and the legacy of pain that comes from that, and it never sees or hardly ever sees where this can lead us to. I mean, I think there must be some wonderful place that out of this pain we can get to. So if you want to remind me that I'm a slave, remind me that my ancestors were slaves. Remind me that they endured this slavery so that I could be here now. And remind me too that I have a responsibility to them and to their ghosts to do something with this legacy of pain that they endured so that I can look back someday and say, yeah, grandfather, you did suffer, but I'm glad you suffered, because without your suffering, I wouldn't be here. And this is what I'm going to do with the pain that you've given me.
During your travels through Africa, you came across a lot of tribal rivalries. And I think it surprised you to find that kind of, well, racism in a way, of blacks directed at other blacks.
Well, when you're a Black American and you're in this country and you hear about Africa, you hear about it as if it is some big one monocultural place of Black dignity where blacks are getting along with blacks and racism doesn't exist. But racism exists on a cultural level, and it doesn't matter what color your skin is. When I'm in Senegal, I found out that a few weeks before, the Mauritanians and the Senegalese have been slaughtering each other, and I had just passed through Nouakchott in Mauritania. And 2 weeks before, because my skin is so dark, I could easily have been mistaken for a Senegalese and had my head chopped off. So racism isn't based solely on color, but simply on being different, and they can tell when you're different, and that's enough. And when you're in the middle of Senegal, because of the markings on your face or the way you carry yourself, they can tell what tribe you're from two blocks away almost.
Your forthcoming book, the book that I believe you're still working on now, is about your motorcycle travels through the Deep South. What inspired that trip?
Africa, actually. And now I think if I'm looking for my roots now, and the roots that I'm looking for are the roots that are in Virginia and Mississippi and Tennessee.
Where did you grow up?
In St. Louis, which is sort of south, sort of north, sort of south. A Midwestern city with a lot of southern tendencies, southern feelings, southern climate.
This forthcoming book is going to be your third book about travels, the first being your solo trip in a canoe down the Mississippi, the second your trip to Africa, and this third one, your motorcycle trip through the Deep South. What keeps you going on these trips?
I don't know what keeps me going, but I'm just a traveling kind of fool, I suppose. And I like to be on the go. But I'm discovering, too, that I'm getting blacker and blacker as time goes by, from book to book to book. In the first book, you could hardly tell that I was black. In the second book, I'm very much black. In the next book, I become an angrier kind of black. So I'm discovering what it is to be black. My growing up, my childhood wasn't particularly racial. I grew up in a mixed neighborhood, I suppose, and went to an all-white high school, and then went off to a major university. And so my experience hasn't been the experience that you see when you turn on the television set, the ghetto, the crime, the dysfunctional family kind of stuff. So life has been pretty cushy, I suppose. And only now am I discovering that being black means more than having dark skin.
So you're getting angrier as you get older. Anger can be very useful or very dangerous. You know what I mean? It could be very self-destructive or it could be very energizing. How do you feel like you're using your anger?
Well, I hope I'm using my anger in my writing and getting to be better as a writer and having a voice that people listen to and can see that being black does not mean being criminal. I mean, one of the things you discover as a black person is that other people, white people, when they see you, the first thing they think of is some sort of a pariah, a criminal, a drug addict, something dangerous, something that they should avoid. I was walking down the street in Saratoga Springs, New York, doing this motorcycle journey, and a white woman on the street clutched her purse, crossed the street, and literally ran away from me just because she saw me on a deserted street with her. So that kind of anger, the anger from incidents like that, make you either want to find her and burn her house down, or find some way to let her know and the rest of the world know that being black is not synonymous with being dangerous, being criminal, being wild, being anything but another human being.
I want to get back to a sentence that you read in the reading you did at the beginning of the interview, and you had said that you wanted to find out what Africa does explain about the ways of black men and women, their ways of walking and their passion, their joys and their sorrows. Do you feel that Africa explained any of that for you, you know?
I'm not sure if it explained any of that, but perhaps it explains black America's endurance. I mean, it seems that we, as a people, have gone through an awful lot. And maybe the only way to be able to endure that much is by virtue of this African kind of lasting. So if Africa explains anything that's in my genes, in our genes, perhaps that's what it is. The ability to suffer and to endure and to be there for tomorrow and hoping that tomorrow is going to be a little bit better.
Eddie Harris, his new book, Native Stranger, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Nick Cohn considered a journey around the world as the subject of his next book. Instead, he traveled up one of the world's most celebrated streets. Coming up, Nick Cohn tells us what he found on Broadway. Conductor Craig Smith has collaborated with director Peter Sellers on contemporary versions of classic operas. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of some of Smith's less controversial work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House Ways and Means Committee today considered and rejected a slimmed-down version of President Bush's election year package of tax cuts and incentives. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
After a bitter partisan brawl, the committee took a series of votes. Along strict party lines, Democrats voted to send President Bush's original plan to the floor without a recommendation. They rejected a pared-down, Republican-backed version of that plan, and then they adjourned to work behind closed doors on their own tax plan. Democrats say that by March 20th, the president's deadline, they will bring to the floor a tax package that includes many measures the president wants. A targeted capital gains tax cut, credits for first-time homebuyers, an investment tax credit for business, plus their own middle-income tax cut paid for by higher taxes on the rich. At that time, the Republicans will also have a chance to offer their own package of tax incentives paid for by accounting changes instead of tax hikes. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush formally began his re-election campaign today, conceding that there's a tough fight ahead, but saying that he will win. Mr. Bush made his announcement in Washington before heading for New Hampshire and campaigning for next year's primary balloting. The Food and Drug Administration has unexpectedly demoted a key member of its advisory panel on silicone gel breast implants. The advisor, Dr. Norman Anderson, made the FDA aware of internal Dow Corning documents that helped convince the agency to call a moratorium on implant use. The FDA will not allow Anderson to vote next week on whether to ban these devices. NPR's Michael Scholer reports.
Dr. Anderson has served as an FDA advisor on breast implants for over a decade and was one of the first to alert the agency to internal Dow Corning documents raising questions about implant safety. Last month, the FDA asked doctors to stop using the silicone gel implants, citing in part new information from those documents, many of which were made public this week. But now the FDA says Anderson has given the appearance, through recent comments in the press, of having already decided that implants should be banned, and so cannot be open-minded. When the advisory panel meets next week to consider the fate of breast implants, Anderson will not have a vote. That pleases plastic surgeons, who have lobbied for several months to get Anderson off the panel's voting roll. Panelists who are plastic surgeons cannot vote either. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 25 points to close at 3,276.83 on volume of 230 million shares. This is NPR News. Heavy rain in Southern California has resulted in mudslides in which at least two people have been killed. As another storm moved in, large motorhomes were swept away by high waters and motorists were stranded. Freeways have been closed by mudslides and flooding, and beaches have also been closed. Rain has been falling since Sunday, and another storm is forecast for this weekend. Up to 10 inches of rain has fallen in some places. Opening arguments were heard from the prosecution today in the federal racketeering and murder trial of reputed organized crime figure John Gotti. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports from New York.
In his 45-minute opening statement, U.S. Attorney Andrew Maloney painted a picture of the inner workings of the Gambino crime family, of which John Gotti is accused of being the boss. He told the jury of five blacks and seven whites that the Gambino family, Gotti, and his co-accused, Frank LoCascio, are part of a national organization of organized crime called the Cosa Nostra. And he told the jury that Gotti conspired to murder former mob boss Paul Castellano in 1985 so he could take his place as the Gambino boss in New York. The state said most of the charges would be proven by a former Gotti associate turned informant, Sammy the Bull Gravano, but that most incriminating would be Gotti's own bragging of the crimes in conversations that were secretly taped by the FBI. The defense will present their scheduled 2-hour opening statement tomorrow. Court was adjourned this afternoon after a juror's father became ill. This is Maria Hinojosa.
A Moscow news agency says that Russia will grant diplomatic recognition to Croatia and Slovenia. According to the Interfax news agency, a Russian official traveled to Yugoslavia earlier this month to explain the move. In the past, Russia has been one of the closest allies of the country's federal government. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Broadway has inspired many songs, movies, and books. You can add to the list a new book called The Heart of the World by my guest Nick Cohn. It's a travel book in which the writer didn't travel very far, just down one street, Broadway, spanning the distance from downtown Manhattan to 59th Street. But in that one street, Cohn says he found the world. He started his career in England, where he wrote about rock and roll and the teen culture of the 60s. He's best known in America for his New York Magazine story about a Brooklyn disco, which was adapted into the film Saturday Night Fever. I asked Nick Cohn why he wanted to write a book about Broadway.
I grew up in Ireland, and in my sort of home background, in the town I grew up in, Broadway had a sort of mythic status, almost like Hollywood might have. Anybody who had any dreams of being a performer or adventuring in any way in life would dream of going to Broadway. And I think that every Irish person who ever arrived in New York, the first thing they'd do would be to go and stand on Times Square. That's what I did. I landed and I suppose 70 minutes later, there I was, looking up.
You and all the other pickpockets.
Well, in those days, there weren't so many.
Yeah. So people think of Broadway as being the place where all the Broadway theaters are, but Broadway's a pretty long street, and there's a lot else that's there. Give us a sense of the part of Broadway that you trekked across.
Well, I started at the Battery, right down at the foot of Broadway, and what makes Broadway unique is that there's hardly an area of human endeavor that isn't encompassed on this one boulevard. So you go through Wall Street, which is abuts Broadway, the City Hall, so you get politics, the law courts are just off. Now the sort of heart of the art world, Soho, that's also on Broadway. The sort of kids, clubs, discos, that's there. Boxing is there, magicians are there. And so by the time you've reached sort of 57th Street, there aren't many aspects of urban life that you haven't brushed across in one way or another.
Now, during the period when you were working on the book, you got a hotel room. Was it off-Broadway in Times Square?
Yes, it was one of the side streets in the 40s.
Was it a real flea bag?
No, it was. It had rules. And the rules included that anyone who used crack openly was ejected, and if you committed an act of violence against another guest, you got an extremely stiff warning.
Well, that's reassuring.
But it did say on the inside the door, there was a little sort of cycle-styled thing with the rates, and it said, discreet accommodations for the discerning few.
Mm-hmm.
So we were dealing with class here.
You're married, aren't you, and you have a home?
Yes, I am. Yes.
So how long did you live away from home for this?
Basically 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Your next-door neighbor at the hotel was a girl who you described as a girl so beautiful it hurt. This was a girl who was really a boy, who went by the name of Lush Life, but whose birth name was Geraldo Cruz.
That's right, yeah.
How did you become friends?
Well, the first night that I was there, she knocked on my door and wanted to borrow my eyeliner. And when she saw that I wasn't really the kind of person who had eyeliner, she forgave me for that and got into conversation. She was an extraordinarily open person without any kind of defenses or disguises. Everything was naked and open in her. she just started to talk. And she became sort of one of my two mentors on Broadway, took me around a great deal, and we became very close.
What kinds of places did she take you to that you otherwise might not have gone to?
Well, she took me to Sally's Hideaway, which is a transvestite bar near Times Square. But she also had friends, transvestite and also not transvestite, because she was very interested in theatre and opera, and she had dreams of a kind of cult stardom, I suppose, herself. I mean, she used to dress up as Madame Butterfly and sing along to opera records and so on.
Lush Life died before your book was published. What happened to her?
She had AIDS.
Oh.
And she hadn't looked after herself very at all. I mean, basically her diet was cheap wine, night train, and so she got ill quite quickly and died within, 9 months.
I'm sure you still go on Broadway for various things. Does the street look very different to you than it did before you started your book?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, when I started off walking, Broadway seemed to me eternal. It changes each generation, it changes. But the idea of a time when there wouldn't be a Broadway or when Broadway would cease to mean anything special, it never occurred to me. But as I began to walk, I realized that it was actually city policy to sell off huge chunks of real estate, which would then be turned into office blocks and lobotomats. And so the character Broadway was under threat. And in the last 5 years, Times Square, the Times Square I know and knew, has virtually disappeared. And half the sort of locations at which I'm talked to people and got to know people are now shut and boarded. So it turned into an obituary without being designed as such.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Nick Cohn. His new book about Broadway is called The Heart of the World. We're going to take a short break and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Nick Cohn is my guest. His new book, The Heart of the World, is about Broadway in Manhattan. Let me ask you about the article that you're probably best known for in America. It was called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night. It was the article that Saturday Night Fever was based on. You wrote it for New York Magazine in June of 76. Everyone, I think, should remember the story. I was set in a disco. It was about somebody coming of age in Brooklyn, and, you know, he's kind of like the king of the disco on Saturday nights. For the rest of the week, he works in a paint store and doesn't much like the work. How did you come about writing the story?
Well, I came to America in 75, and after I grew up in Ireland, and I then went to London in the what is now known as the swinging 60s, and I'd seen the mods in Shepherd's Bush, and which was the beginning of the whole mod movement in London. And when I came to America and I started to be taken around by various people to discos and so on, I could see the same kind of obsessions that I'd seen in London in the 60s, the absolute fixation on the weekend, on clothes, and on dancing, and also on the negative side, the same complete male-dominated world in which women were treated absolutely just as props. And this interested me.
Now, you've said that this article, which was printed as a piece of journalism, as a fact piece, was actually fiction. Did your editor know this?
I didn't really have an editor. I don't know. I don't think it really came up.
How could you not have had an editor? I mean, there had to be an editor.
It must have been. Let me think about this carefully. No, I think that the editor probably thought that there was a Tony Manero.
So you didn't think it was your responsibility to tell him that it was a fiction piece?
In those days, I was probably very irresponsible. And no, I didn't particularly, I didn't think about it. I didn't think it through. It didn't seem at that point tremendously damaging. I felt that there was a reality to the story, emotional reality, as indeed, you know, people from Brooklyn who I showed it to felt there was. But I didn't think that was the important thing. Whether it was what seemed important to me was it real rather than was it true?
The Saturday Night Fever story was about a disco scene. You were in England during what we in America think of as the British invasion period.
That's right, yes.
So what was the scene that you were a part of when you moved to London?
Well, that was the time when all the rock groups, which later became the major rock groups, were just starting. The Who were still called the High Numbers. The Rolling Stones had probably produced two singles or something. You could still hear these bands in clubs. And so it was everything was just starting. And there was an extraordinary feeling. I mean, I was 17, I think, when I went to London, that anything was possible. Suddenly, 45-year-old editors, publishers, record producers were scared to turn you down in case you might... you know, they might turn around and they'd let the Beatles go. I think the most important thing that happened in England was that the Beatles were turned down by Decca Records. And everybody from then on in positions of power were terrified they'd do the same thing. So, in other words, one had carte blanche. The same people who would have kicked you out the door if you'd asked for a job in 1963, by 1965 couldn't wait to get you in there fast enough.
So how did you take advantage of that?
Well, I left school at 15. I had no education whatsoever. I walked into a newspaper called The Observer, which is a national Sunday paper, and they gave me a job, which they certainly wouldn't have done a year or two before.
Writing about rock?
Writing about... Really, my subject was sort of street culture, always, and that included rock. And I wrote quite a bit about rock music, but only for a couple of years. It's funny, very odd now... to still find myself in some reviews referred to as rock journalist. Well, I didn't actually make my living... I haven't made my living as a rock journalist since 1968. But once you get that label on you, it's yours for life, I suppose.
You were very passionate about rock during that period, weren't you?
I was very passionate about it for about 3 or 4 years. But I always felt that it was something for the very young. And really, after I got past 21, I began to think, you're hanging on a bit. And when I was 22, I wrote a book called What Bop a Loo Bop a Lat Bam Boom, which was the first history of rock. And that was really my farewell to the business.
You've said before that you've really disliked rock stars who present themselves as working class heroes. And I guess just in the context of that, I was wondering if you felt at all that you were slumming during your Broadway period.
No, because... I felt that these people that I was talking to were teaching me a lot more than I was teaching them. In fact, I wasn't teaching them at all in most cases. There was a phrase that kept haunting me all through the book. It sounds rather pretentious to say, but there's a book, a 17th century book, called The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton. At one point in it, he's looking through some letters... but it's equivalent of looking in the morning paper. And in a sort of tumultuous sentence, he says, you know, I see these reports of murders, of famines, and I see one man rising in the world, one ruined, one marriage happy, one man. And he goes through all the events of the day. And then with a dash, he says, the misery and the gallantry of the world. Well, the misery of some elements of Broadway, that's very obvious. But the gallantry, that's what attracted me. And the people that appear in the book are people that I think, even though they might not be sort of pillars of the community from the normal capitalist point of view, They all of them have tremendous courage, sense of style, and they made a life. So far from slumming, in the majority of cases, I felt, you know, quite privileged to know them.
Nick Cohn's new book about Broadway is called The Heart of the World. It's published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. President Bush wants a second term as president of the United States. We have a formal announcement today, and Mr. Bush is off campaigning now in New Hampshire. Our colleague Linda Wertheimer is also in New Hampshire, and she's located Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa, who's running a bit behind in the polls as a Democratic candidate. They'll have a conversation. Also, Hillary Brown reports from Kuwait on the status of environmental damage to that country after the Persian Gulf War. Wendy Kaufman on flooding in Los Angeles. And Richard Harris on new alarm in the Bush administration about damage to the ozone layer above us all.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maybe you saw the contemporary adaptations of three Mozart operas on PBS. They were directed by Peter Sellers. The conductor was Craig Smith. Smith has a new recording of a much less theatrical nature. It's an album of motets by Heinrich Schütz, the greatest German composer before Bach. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says this is choral music of profound spirituality and emotional intensity.
I love the musicians of Boston's Emmanuel Church, and I think you'll hear why when you listen to their new recording of Schütz motets. Emmanuel Church is just down the street from the Ritz Hotel on Boston's fashionable Newbury Street. But the attitude of these musicians is far from what you'd associate with a fashionable or trendy clientele. In 1970, Emmanuel's music director, Craig Smith, and his extraordinary and extraordinarily dedicated group began to perform the Bach cantatas the way Bach wrote them, in order and as part of the liturgy. For 7 years, Bach's cantatas were part of the weekly Sunday service at Emmanuel Church. This was one of the few times since Bach, and the first time in this country, that the cantatas were performed this way. Eventually, the group branched out. Their annual Mozart birthday concerts are among Boston's most popular musical events. They're now benefits for the AIDS Action Committee. The young stage director, Peter Sellers, heard about the American premieres of uncut Handel operas at Emmanuel. The meeting of Sellers and Smith has led to one of the most memorable collaborations in 20th century opera history. Their Mozart and Handel operas have included many Emmanuel singers and musicians. Some of the wilder ideas for these productions actually originated not with flamboyant Peter Sellers, but with soft-spoken Craig Smith. Now Smith has returned to one of his first loves, Heinrich Schütz. The small chamber chorus on this new recording is made up of some of America's finest young singers. The soprano section, for example, includes early music diva Lorraine Hunt, the celebrated contemporary music specialist Carol Bennett, and Jane West, who sang the Countess in the PBS Marriage of Figaro. All the singers blend their voices in a sublimely pure vision of art and spirit. That was a selection from one of the five Passion motets on this Emmanuel Music Schütz album. Schütz was born exactly 100 years before Bach and lived to be nearly 90 through all the political and religious turmoil of the 30 Years' War. His music internalizes almost an entire century. I have an old musical encyclopedia from 1924. It says, Schütz, Heinrich, 1585 to 1672, 17th century, Germany. That's the complete entry. Of course, we now know a lot more about early music. Schütz has taken his rightful place among the greatest composers who ever lived. This wonderful recording is living evidence of that position and of what can happen when the most talented musicians give themselves to an ideal beyond the furthering of their own careers.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the motets of Heinrich Schütz on the Koch International label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the selling of Star Wars. Science writer William Broad tells us how physicist Edward Teller used his fame and influence to create the $25 billion Strategic Defense Initiative, despite evidence that it couldn't work. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.